Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 113, Software Defined Storage 101.1. Here we go. Tonight, my guest is back, Jason Perlow. How you doing, Jason?
Hey, Rickatron. What's up, man? Rock and roll. It's been a while.
I'm good. Actually, I had to look it up. You were last on at episode like 104. On January 13th, we recorded.
Oh,
January 15th. Yeah.
January 15th.
What's happened since then?
Yeah, January 15th was a very important day.
Yeah. I got you right before that important day. What happened?
I went in for surgery. I had a procedure called a vertical sleeve gastrectomy, and that is when they remove most of your stomach. So they've got this cool. Well, now they can do it with robots, but the surgeon I think mostly used assistants, but they use probes, and so they make a couple incisions into your abdominal area, small ones. So there's not a lot of blood loss. I mean, as I understand, there's only about 10 cc's of blood loss in an entire surgery, which is not much at all. You lose more blood when you get blood tests. So they go in with these probes, and they have this probe that, at the same time, while it's cutting, it sutures with titanium. So basically what you're left with is a stomach the shape and size of a banana, so about 6 ounces of eating capacity. And I was 366 pounds, and I am now 250.
Wow, and I'm doing a Google search. And it literally is just like you described. I'll just Google image search, guys, or a Bing image search. Be prepared for both amazing before and afters. And then the view that you see from these scopes, it's very interesting of a procedure. And I can tell you, Jason is a new person. You know, I follow Jason on Twitter. I follow him on Instagram. And Jason is actually even kind of re-established his Off the Broiler blog, which I'll put links to that in the podcast notes. And he's also kept his Tech Broiler blog at ZDNet, which is actually, you know, Jason, that's how we met. I don't know how many years ago. Those different families of sites. So, and of course, Jason's on Twitter at JPerlow. Great story. And just, you know, on behalf of me, I'm really happy for both you and your wife for that transition at, you know, probably saved your life. I was reading the post that you
put. Oh, there's no question.
Title. Where did Jason go? That's a great topic, too. And, no, great story. And you sound better. You look better. And I haven't bumped into you yet in person, but happy to hear all that.
Yeah. It's been an interesting transformation, to be sure. And while we're talking about transformations, I guess we should get into the topic at hand, the data center transformation that's taking place in a lot of enterprises.
You know, there is a transformation, and before we had this notion of software-defined storage, I was actually in my own blogging, I was using this phrase of the Renaissance revival of direct attached storage. And let me explain how I saw this a couple of years ago. Basically, servers and their storage systems, not SANs, not you know, proper storage systems, like from a storage perspective, but the base server bit, they're really capable today. We've got larger capacity drives. I mean, there used to be a time that you would use a SAN for capacity reasons, but today, I mean, drive capacities, there's a performance that goes with it, but with larger capacity drives, but there's really an incredible amount of functionality. And then let's, you know, look at what we are today. There's this whole market of software-defined storage. So before we go into any specifics, you know, Jason, how would you describe software-defined storage, you know, to someone new to the industry, or heck, you know, it's the holidays, maybe your mom, right? How would you, you know, explain software-defined storage to someone?
Okay. Well, if I was talking to my mom or my mother-in-law, I would basically say, well, you know, the hard drives that go in your $300 computer from Costco? We take the same cheap $50 hard drives, and we put them in a giant refrigerator-sized cabinet, and instead of using really expensive computers to run them. We just, if a couple of them die in the process, we have such amount of parity and repetition across those hundreds of drives that we don't really care if there's a failure. What we would say is redundancy is built into the architecture. So
Exactly.
in the olden days, we would be very much worried about designing hardware solutions that were redundant in the I would say the component design, right? Whereas so we were more concerned about more concerned about having dedicated sort of systems that were designed specifically for storage rather than them being as part of a larger organism, so to speak. I guess that's the way I would say it. I mean, let's I mean, but it's provisioning too, right? And agility is important, is just as important. So I think what we've seen here is that we're now coming upon an age where everything is commoditized, right? The computers are commoditized, the hardware is commoditized. There really isn't any need for proprietary systems in general, right? So if we look at how enterprises have needed, we've had this age where there are these monolithic proprietary systems, and they all kind of worked in sort of silos, right? So now it doesn't make sense to have silos because all the systems are starting to become homogeneous. Right, we're basically creating a compute infrastructure, that's basically whether it's all x86, and we have this we've perfected virtualization. Now we're getting into these technologies like containerization, and now we're saying, okay, so now that we've figured out the compute side of things, how to scale, how to build that data center infrastructure cheaply on the compute side. What do we do for storage? Now, storage has always been a very big cost center. Whether it's an enterprise or a service provider, it's expensive. These storage frames are very expensive. Now, this is not to say that there's
Probably the most important hardware in the data center. I'd argue that, right?
it actually I
I
would
mean,
say
network.
it's at least one third of your hardware cost, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more expensive than servers. Network is the only bit even close,
Right.
and it really depends on how you do it. There's some softwares, especially some really fancy databases,
Yeah, and
that
storage
maybe.
is always being consumed, and for the most part, you're not freeing it up in a lot of environments because of regulatory reasons or whatnot. And the thing is, there's nothing wrong with having your high performance, proprietary SAN system, right? There's a lot of environments where you've got to have those things just because they deliver a measured level of performance and reliability that is a known quantity. Okay, but that doesn't mean that you need to have 7 years worth of archival information necessarily sitting on your fastest nearline storage, right? So let's look at how the Amazons and the Azures and the Facebooks and the Googles of the world build their infrastructure, right? They have tremendous amounts of data that is being stored, right? Historically, right? And they can't get rid of that. You got these people like me with their Gmail accounts with like 10 years of crap that they've never gotten rid of, right? Because they just keep getting more and more and more and more and more and more storage. So they're not
You're
going to
that guy that's
I'm that
You do
guy.
that email file system, EFS, email file system. Is that you?
Exactly, right. I mean, I got probably
Okay.
a million unread emails of spam that I could probably use to destroy. But people look at my email inbox, they're going like, dude, you need to clean this up. I'm like, why? So if Google's, needs to, and Facebook needs to archive all this stuff, if Twitter needs to archive all this stuff, they're not necessarily putting, today's data, the most frequently accessed data, in their most expensive storage. You can use commodity hard drives, right? So basically, essentially, the almost the same kind of drives in the cheap computers, or maybe a little bit a grade level up. Or mix, right? You can buy super fast SSD, you can buy mid-range, 15K drives, and you can also buy those bulk, storage drives that are very, very inexpensive SATA type stuff, right? So
Right,
you can mix your bus architectures, you can mix your all that stuff. But what storage virtualization does allows you to pool, like-minded types of storage and abstract them as they're presented to your virtualization hosts. And all that work is being done at the at by an operating system instead of like a dedicated storage controller like an EMC or a NetApp or something like that. So literally you're taking
sure.
a server OS and you're turning it into a giant NAS, right? Now, in the olden days, we had storage abstraction. Like IBM, for example, when I was at IBM, they had an appliance that basically was used to front end against different vendors' storage
The
systems.
SVC.
Right. And the SVC was great, but it was super expensive, right? And so, but today we can do that completely in software, right? So something like storage spaces, right? You can front end an EMC, you can front end a NetApp, and you can front end a cheap old JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And those can all be presented to your virtualization host, in this case Hyper-V, as abstracted storage, and your in this case something like VMM, right, can be set up to tier, right, the different types of storage you have according to whatever tenant needs what, or whatever department needs what, or whatever workload needs what, right? So you don't have to go
So
crazy
let's
figuring
stop
out
right
min
there.
yeah
Stop right there, because the hyper public cloud and mega public service example doesn't apply to everyone in their data center.
No.
But this example here, commodity hardware, we all in business data centers can get that. The idea of leveraging common server OSs and the stuff we use, storage spaces is one. I've got a future episode we're going to talk about VMware vSAN. There's a lot of technologies out there. So this is much more practical for the end user to kind of latch on to this node of or this notion of scaling out across nodes and different resources, setting rules with equipment they have, with operating systems they know how to use, and practical things like running VMs. So it's a very applicable way of going out with the benefits of scale and abstraction. Is that kind of a good way of putting it?
Benefits of scale, abstraction, and simplifying your overall architecture. And again, I mean, I'm using, Microsoft as an example, right? It's not the only valid, cloud and storage virtualization solution out there. In actuality, there have been the predecessors to it have existed in Unix and Linux for a long time. ZFS, for example, on Solaris 10, had the notion of complete software-based storage pooling, right? And there have been other things in Unix and in Linux, and of course, companies like Amazon and Google have used these types of solutions to build their own infrastructures for their specific offerings, right? So now those technologies are filtering down to the enterprise, and it's become much more interesting now with the introduction of converged networking, right? So now you don't need Not only do you not need the super expensive SAN hardware, but you also don't need fiber channel, right? You can have a single network running on 10 gigi or 40 gigi, or they'll even have 100 gigi, soon enough. You drop in a converged switch where you have both your network traffic for your servers and hosts on the same, network, actually, virtual VLANs essentially, which is going to separate them. The storage traffic, of course, would be different on different virtual networks, but you could use the same switch infrastructure to have hosts that run your storage. And so.
That's one of those things that, I look at the equipment of in that space right there, that hyper-converged space. I remember a couple years ago, I think it was 2009, that Cisco UCS came onto the market. Was honestly at the time, they were really touting the newest milestones of the backplane and the fabric interconnects, and I didn't really get it at the time. But when we look at what's going on right now, man, that's great kit. to go down this route. I'd call the Cisco UCS probably the best of the market server, so it's not commodity. But where it does really good is the management, the provisioning, all that kind of stuff. And then when you consider you have this type of abstraction for the rest of it from the storage and we've already got the compute bit, those two things work really well together right there, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this stuff is, again, this is a reference architecture that any enterprise can use with any runs hardware for the most part. Actually, for the storage space of stuff, actually, if you take a look, there was a white paper, I think, that was published by Dell, I think it was in 2014, about how to take their MD series JBOD enclosures, combine it with, you know, regular rack mount Dell servers, and use Microsoft software, Hyper-V, you know, System Center and Server 2012 R2 to present, you know, that type of storage spaces infrastructure to whatever Hyper-V host that you have. Now, you could take that same architecture that Dell published and use Lenovo servers. You could do that with HP servers. You could do that
right.
with Cisco servers. As long as you have, in this case, SAS, right? Backplane controllers and all that. And pretty soon you're going to be able to do it just with SATA. You won't even need to use SAS. You'll be able to replicate across JBOD storage frames that just use plain old SATA. You can replicate that exact architecture. And in fact, this is the same exact architecture that Azure uses. I mean, it's not a secret sauce. Microsoft published the specs on what hardware they use, and it's nothing fancy. It's off the shelf stuff. That is, you know, you fill a container, literally like a shipping container, from a tractor trailer full of blades. I think it's like even open air conditioning. It's not even, they don't even have cases, and you know, switches and pretty much commodity JBOD stuff, you know, like, you know, literally the stuff you would find at Supermicro or whatever. And they build pods of what they call scale units. So a scale unit would contain a certain amount of compute and a certain amount of storage and a certain amount of network switches, and that's what they call a scale unit for a data center. And they build them up like Lego bricks, and they keep adding them as needed. You know, and that is the data center of the future.
The X-ray of the hyperpublic cloud is exactly what you said, and I've been speaking with people from other hyperpublic clouds, and it is just as you describe. It's equipment on a truck, and this master node provisions what they're going to do, and they just literally scale out in the ultimate fashion, built on commodity and designs like that. So it's a really interesting time, because Microsoft, in this example, and, you know, just disclosure, guys, Jason works for Microsoft.
Yep.
He's the first one I'm going to have on. I'm going to have others with different perspectives, but, you know, when you look at an operating system, you look at technologies like storage spaces, you look at the connectivity options between SAS, SATA, direct attached, iSCSI, and all these other things. But I need to highlight something. And you mentioned 2014, that white paper that came out. Since Windows Server 2012, I have to say that Microsoft has really kind of graduated and kind of arrived to the mainstream storage discussion, and I really don't think it gets enough kind of street cred. And SMB3 is another example, a great way to run VMs over a true kind of graduated, ready for production network protocol, which, you know, a lot of people don't know about that, but you can do that now with Hyper-V. So I think that, you know, we're going into 2016, but probably 2-3 years ago, I'd say that a lot of these options really came into play. Is that pretty fair?
Yep. 2012 R2 is really when, you know, we saw the SMB3 and the RDMA stacks really start to mature, and the RDMA controller cards for Ethernet really start to mature, and we, you know, stuff coming out of who are the two major vendors that do it is. My brain is like completely freezing up right now. But
you should not do podcasts at 10 p.m. then.
Yeah, you shouldn't do podcasts at 10 p.m. Mellanox, and there was one other one. that are very popular for doing RDMA over converged Ethernet or what they call a RoCE. Is the if you look up the RoCE Alliance, that's the overarching
Wait.
industry ROCE. So that's the overarching
Oh, okay.
certification, I guess, industry alliance between networking vendors that support that standard of doing converged RDMA over Ethernet standard RDMA, so that ROCE.
So, yeah, of course, all good podcasts are based on Wikipedia. And the RDMA over converged Ethernet, I see what you're getting out here. There's a adaptable protocol. It's been, a spec. It's been updated, and
It's not just for
basically,
storage. It's not just for storage. It's specifically for high
right.
bandwidth applications, of which storage is one of them. So there'll be other cool stuff that you'll be able to do with RoCE besides storage.
Got it. Cool. Stay tuned for that. And then actually, then there's all ReFS. We have, that's a whole new kind of emerging thing that's and I don't even get ReFS. I mean, we can all go to the page, but if you had to explain it to somebody over the holidays, how would you explain ReFS?
So I mean, you have the traditional NTFS, right? That's used a lot for, it's been used in NT for since the beginning, really, right? So it's a good, gosh, NTFS came out in what, like 1992, when NT was first released, and now we're at like NTFS version 5X or something like that. I can't keep up with the
Sure.
versions. So basically, it's a reimagining of the Windows Server file system, and it's optimized for certain types of workloads, right? So for containers, for example, SQL and other types of things, it's very good for it. Now, of course, you have to size your workload appropriately. Again, in some cases, NTFS may still be better for certain things than REFS. But it's a new style file system that is quickly being adopted for certain high capacity workloads. Just like in Linux, you have different file systems that are used for different things. It's a new type of file system that's used for specific things more and more.
And as I look at the options, they're so increased. And this one will be kind of generally focused on the Windows, skill set this podcast will. But I look at like it's just getting started. Like ReFS, for example, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't it's not supported for boot volumes
Correct.
currently. It's planned to go that route. But it's one of those things that one of my Veeam Vanguards, which for the listeners, if you guys don't know, is my new, not my, but Veeam's new influencer program, a la MVP vExpert for Veeam of sorts. And Didier Van Hooy from the Netherlands, or from Belgium, not the Netherlands, he has been playing a lot with ReFS. And he's doing these benchmarks, and maybe I'll put a link in the blog to it. This guy's done all this stuff in PowerShell, and he's showing how that these different situations perform better with ReFS compared to ODX and NTFS. I mean, it's really encouraging the innovation we're seeing in this space. And then when you apply this innovation, it comes down to speeds and feeds, and it comes down to easier management, scale out, better provisioning, and honestly, just simpler configuration. Couple that with commodity equipment, less cost, etc. We're really paving the way for especially those in the private cloud space to really dial up a very prescribed performance profile that can do basically anything they need to do in that data center
Right.
and
So
really be ready for anything.
really what we're talking about is, cloud blueprints and design patterns, right? So it used to be a lot harder to come up with this stuff because you had so many multi-vendor factors that came into play, such as, specific firmwares used on specific, RAID controllers and specific type of Ethernet adapters used for certain types of switches. And it was a lot of vendor finger pointing occurred when you didn't get the performance, that you wanted. But
Right.
now that we can move a lot of this into software and not have to worry so much about proprietary chips and things like that, it's a lot easier to come up with these design patterns and to repeat Repeat the recipe each time rather than coming up, with a random, dish. As much as I like to go to
Sure.
restaurants and get, a surprise, and I sometimes you want consistency, especially when you're building data centers. It's nice to get a surprise when I go to my sushi guy and he gives me something a little bit different on occasion, but that's not what I want. Not what I want when I'm building a
You know,
hyperscale cloud.
I got to tell you this story, Jason, only because you're a foodie. So, about 10 years ago, I had a customer in Mexico, central Mexico, really good food in this part of the in this part of Mexico, it's the San Luis Potosí state. And on the menu at this restaurant was something called tacos sorpresas. It's surprise tacos. And I got it one day, and Jason, I kid you not, there were three distinct different meats, one of which was not chicken. Okay, I don't know what was going on in there, but it was really good, but I didn't want to look or taste or analyze the texture too close. Some surprises are good, some are not. Interesting. Well, hey, so, as we go into the future, I mean, just kind of speculatory, what do you see software-defined storage bringing to private data centers in particular? What do you see the surprise or, the expectation that you're going to see into the future? What do you see coming?
So So really, it's really software defined everything, not just software defined storage, right? But at the end of the day, what you're going to see is the private data center is going to end up running stacks that are similar or almost identical to the stacks that the hyperscale public clouds are going to run, so that you can actually minimize the amount of infrastructure you have in your private data center and use the burst mode capabilities of public clouds as you have a hybrid, right? So that you can minimize your CapEx, because at the end of the day, you only need to have the infrastructure running at any time that the workload requires. You don't want to overbuy for peaks, right? So like, let's say you're like an
Sure.
H&R Block or something, you know that you're going to have the most amount of transactions during tax season, right? But you don't want to buy your data center for tax season, right? When
Right.
all the other months of the year you're running at 20% capacity, you want to buy for what you need, right? Or the average of what you need. So when you have your storage and your compute infrastructure and your virtualization, your cloud solution is the same as what the hyperscale providers can do, whether it's Microsoft or it's Azure or Google or what have you, you can then migrate workloads and storage much easier. You're not taking, data that's basically not transportable and trying to use some migration tool utility to move stuff into the cloud in some funky way. No, it's going to be API interoperable. So it's going to be just as easy as just writing a script that says, beam this storage over to or beam these VMs or beam this data set over to the cloud and now scale and now elasticize or something like that. That's what we're going to see in
Sure.
the future. Is a completely cross vendor, cross cloud, best of breed. The customer gets to pick what works for them solution rather than being locked into stuff.
Nice. Nice. And I think honestly is, these changes are coming down, this abstraction, this anti-lock-in. This really translates to business agility because the whole dawn of take that H&R Block example, take the Amazon.com shopping example. This is something that really created the hyperpublic clouds, right? If you look backwards in the history of this. So these technologies are transportable. They're going to end up in people's data centers. The Azure Pack is a great example, or Azure Stack for private clouds and such. So I think we're on the verge of great things, and hopefully, when it comes to software-defined storage, we have a good sense of what we are doing now and what's coming. And stay tuned for the next episode for the listeners. I'm going to get at least one or two different more perspectives on the software-defined storage. Jason, you might remember the Solid State of the Union. Remember we did that a
Oh
few times?
yeah, oh yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, because it always comes down to storage, and I got three different perspectives on solid state storage, actually four. And I'm going to try to do the same for the software-defined storage space. So, Perlo, a real pleasure to have you on the podcast once again.
Awesome, Rick.